Welcome to Warships Pod, which is the podcast of Warships International Fleet Review magazine. I'm Ian Ballantyne, I'm the editor of the magazine. And today I'm joined by Chris Carr, the dynamic man behind the scenes of the podcast. And he and I will be discussing Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom, which is a new documentary to be broadcast on Channel 4 at 6:55pm on the 30th of October. And the reason it's of interest, hopefully, to Warships IFR readers and to people in general, is that it tells the story of an amazing episode in the Second World War at sea. And I have a special connection with it in that it's based on my book, published by Agora Books, of the same name, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom. And it's taken 10 years to get there, but finally it's out there for you to all enjoy. So I'd like to hand over now to Chris to interrogate me and tease out some exciting elements of the documentary and also the book. But before we start our chat, here's the trailer for Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom.
She just blew up.
We couldn't believe it. Just couldn't believe it.
There were only three survivors.
And we then heard that Bismarck was on the loose.
Once Bismarck had sunk Hood and disappeared into the grey vastness of the Atlantic, the British didn't really have an idea what he was going to do next.
We got into some very, very bad weather. We were losing hands over the side.
I was scared, certainly. You'd be a fool not to be.
We knew perfectly well we were going to fly, because if we didn't fly, there would be no tomorrow for us. This was really scary. When we broke from the cloud, we were on our own. All around us, there is thundering noise. The aircraft is shaking. Bismarck was on the port side, and she just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Can take nothing away from the Germans. Their gunnery was out of this world.
You could see the shells coming towards you.
I actually saw one of the back of the B-turret actually explode, and the back of B-turret just flipped up in the air like a penny.
She was being mercilessly pounded.
Gosh, that trailer's really powerful, isn't it, Ian?
And that's just a taster of what's in the documentary. And it's absolutely brilliant to see and hear the veterans. And, of course, there's all sorts of exciting stuff in the full programme.
Yeah, it's very powerful, especially hearing the veterans' voices. So, Ian, where did this all begin? Talk to us about your book, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom.
The book is based on transcripts of on-camera interviews that I did with a select band of veterans from the Royal Navy who were engaged in the pursuit and destruction of Bismarck. Mm. And I went round the UK and worked with a cameraman named Stuart Antrobus, who's a fine fellow who I've known for some years and who freelances for the BBC in exotic parts of the world. And the pair of us visited the veterans in the southwest of England, in Wales, the north of England, and actually the east of England too. But I also sent Stuart to Canada, armed with questions, to talk to a man who was in the last Swordfish to attack Bismarck on the 26th of May 1941. And I had already established a rapport with that chap, and we'll talk about him in a minute. But The point is that the book is based on transcripts of those people, and of course there's more in it than that to set the scene, but that's the core of it. And I did the book deliberately because I knew I had that footage of the veterans who give remarkable testimony, and I wanted to get it out there and also tempt somebody, hopefully, to make it into a documentary. And that's what we've got on Channel 4 on Saturday, the 30th of October.
Fantastic. And this is not your only book on the Bismarck, is it?
No, I've done two others that are related to it. And on my bismarckbattle.com website that I've set up especially for Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom and the other books, the other two books, you can find details there. But the main thrust of what I'm talking about today and I've been doing for all of this year and previous to that is to get Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom out there and into people's consciousness.
So what was it that drew you to the Bismarck story and led to these books?
Well, when I was a kid, my brother my older brother, had C.S. Forrester's book, Sink the Bismarck. And I thought the painting on the cover of Bismarck was quite extraordinary. It was an action painting. And also, I read a few bits of it. I didn't read all of it. That came many years later. And so that was the first time I was aware of this episode. And I must have been about 12 at the time. Mm. And so that was when I first encountered it. But as somebody who worked as a defense reporter and interviewed many World War II veterans some 30 to 40 years later, I grew interested in British naval history. And of course, the Bismarck action, as it's called by the Royal Navy, was something that had a defined beginning, middle and end, and involved a distinct cast list of vessels on both sides, the German and the British side, and was very, very dramatic. And it's just one of the exciting, compelling episodes of history and World War II history in particular.
Can you talk to us about then this documentary and how it sort of came about and what it shows?
The thing about World War II veterans is that many of them didn't talk about what they had seen and done in the conflict for many, many decades. And often they wouldn't say anything about it to their families, nor would they get together even in reunions to talk about it. It was just something they went through. They decided to put behind them. Maybe they were traumatized. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were just, that's enough. I've lived that for 4 or 5 years. I don't want to talk about it or live it anymore. So often what you found was that they would not get together to tell stories and remember past events and comrades or shipmates in this case until, let's say, the 1980s, because that's when they retired and they thought, well, actually, what we did back then was quite remarkable. And maybe it is worth getting together with our shipmates and or our comrades in arms and discussing it, because, you know, they were bad times, but they were also good times. And I'd like to see them again. So you found that a lot of warship associations were established when these men were in their 60s or 70s or 50s. And then they would get together once a year and talk about the ship that they served in, or the unit they served in, or the squadron, the Naval Air Squadron, or the RAF Squadron, or the Army Battalion, whatever. And they would then have a reunion every year, and they'd have a dinner somewhere that was meant something to the ship and themselves. And that's how it progressed for many years. And then somebody like myself, who had grown interested in the human element of World War II, and the fact that warships actually are a bit like army regiments. They are what ties thousands of people together. They all serve in the same ship, so they have these amazing experiences that the vessels carry them through. So I was interested in going to these reunions, and I was lucky enough to start going to them in the 1990s and meeting these veterans in the 1990s when they came to pay remembrance at various naval war memorials too, and started to think, well, actually, I think there's books here and there's news stories here. Because often, and this is the case with the Bismarck action, the Bismarck episode, the stories that were written by people like Ludovic Kennedy and the gunnery officer in Bismarck were published in the 60s or the early 70s or even, you know, like 1980. But there were many more stories out there that weren't in print, from junior ratings, junior officers, the very junior people that were not being told in books. And I investigated in archives as well, like the Naval Museum at Portsmouth or the Imperial War Museum or at Greenwich, the museum there in London. And I found astonishing stuff and new stuff. And I was given material in the case of HMS Rodney, a battleship that fought Bismarck, new material that I thought added a new twist to it all. So I produced a book called Killing the Bismarck and another book called HMS Rodney. But then after all that, I thought, well, actually, there's still more out there. And there are actually more people out there who have got in touch with me, who really, what I should do is I should go and interview them on camera, because I'd done a bit of script writing for corporate productions for a company in London. So I'd acquired that talent or that instinct. And so I got together with Stuart. I asked Stuart if he'd help me. And so we began this project in 2011 to go and film the veterans. And it was only about half a dozen of them. And to their credit, these by then rather elderly gentlemen, some of whom I'd met at reunions, others had got in touch with me, and others I got in touch with, were very patient with me and allowed me to sit down with them in their homes with Stuart filming them and chat about their extraordinary experiences.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Then you got all that on tape. That's brilliant.
Yeah. And the thing is, they often would not have talked about that stuff. Certainly back to what I said earlier, they wouldn't have talked about that stuff much to their families, if at all. And they hadn't really perhaps thought about certain elements of it as being remarkable. And for me, the exciting thing was to get them on camera talking about it and delivering it direct to us, unfiltered by my keyboard, shall we say, and so direct to the viewer, so they could hear what really really happen. And that's the important thing to understand about these chaps, is that they were among the few in the warships that fought Bismarck in 1941 and pursued her that actually saw what happened in the final battle, because not many people in a warship actually saw what was happening because they were buttoned up below decks or closed up action stations, as they call it.
So did any of the, so you met all these veterans, did any particular meetings or recording of these conversations sort of stand out for you?
I think they were all outstanding in their way. And although some may have been in ships prior to the one they served in that fought Bismarck and afterwards that didn't do, let's say, as much or weren't involved in the same kind of dramatic incidents, the things that they saw, experienced, felt when they were engaged in pursuing Bismarck and in the final battle, each one of these veterans had something, whether it was a short bit or several anecdotes that, for me, added to the insight that we should have into the reality of naval warfare, the horror, the awe, you know, the humour and the downside of it all, the terrible things that happen. So there was a kind of a mix of their emotions and their feelings and what they saw across the board. Each one of them said something that was vivid and interesting about the Bismarck battle or the Bismarck action.
I was quite moved by the just some of the descriptions of the survivors of the HMS Hood and just sort of waiting to be rescued. There's only three of them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the book, Bismarck 24 Hours of Doom, and the documentary touch briefly on what happened to HMS Hood as a precursor, an essential precursor to the main elements of the documentary, which is the final 24 hours of the chase and the battle. Because to understand what the veterans felt when they were pursuing Bismarck, this mighty German battleship that had just destroyed HMS Hood, you know, you have to understand what they were feeling about that and what a powerful effect it had on them. So to explain what happened with HMS Hood, HMS Hood was an elderly battle cruiser that was actually laid down in the First World War, began construction in the First World War, finished in the 1920s, but then was considered this most graceful of warships and toured the world as a what they call a warship grey ambassador, you know, doing the thing they would call today defence diplomacy, making friends, influencing people and showing potential foes that she was, at the time, the most powerful and biggest warship in the world. But by the Second World War, she hadn't been rebuilt to the extent she needed to be. She was elderly, but still looked powerful. And as a battle cruiser, and this is a bit of a nerdy thing, but a battle cruiser is in essence a gigantic cruiser, which is not as heavily armoured as a battleship. And so the battleship is another level above a battle cruiser. And Hood had the same guns as Bismarck, 15-inch guns, mighty big guns. But she had, she was an older ship. She wasn't as well protected and not quite as fast. And when Bismarck was built by the Nazi regime in Germany in the 1930s, just prior to the war, she was modern, fast, and had big guns. I mean, there were flaws in the Bismarck design below the surface, but in terms of contrast to Hood, she was bigger, more powerful, and faster. So on the 24th of May 1941, Hood was sent north because the Royal Navy was spread across the Atlantic and Hood was the vessel available. Hood was sent north to the Denmark Strait between Iceland and Greenland in company with a brand new battleship called HMS Prince of Wales and some destroyers to confront Bismarck and Prince Eugen, a heavy cruiser that was with Bismarck coming down around Iceland through the Denmark Strait and attempted to break out into the Atlantic to devastate, if they could, Allied convoys, British convoys, going from Canada and North America to Britain with war supplies that were needed to keep Britain in the fight against Nazi Germany. So that's the scene there. Those two British ships confront the two German ships. And as it says in the documentary, within 8 minutes of fire opening, Hood was blown apart. And of the 1,418 sailors and Royal Marines in HMS Hood, all but three of them were killed. So there were only three survivors out of 1,418. And you mentioned those guys on biscuit floats waited to be rescued. Well, that was those three men. And actually, in the book, I do give a little bit of detail on those three survivors waiting as a precursor. And then the shock, and this is where we come back to the documentary that people can see, the sheer shock in the homes and the pubs, you know, people stopping on street corners to discuss, you know, Hood has gone, blown apart with terrible, terrible loss of life was quite powerful. And of course, the world saw this and thought, is the game up with Britain? You know, they can't handle the German Navy and they can't, you know, protect their convoys. So, for example, for the Americans, they might have thought, well, is there any point in carrying on supplying Britain, keeping Britain in the war, if they can't handle the two German high seas raiders, the Bismarck and Prinz Eugen? You know, that's the general precursor to the main story.
Yeah, and this is all before the Americans really officially enter the war, isn't it?
You're right. I mean, the Americans were unofficially helping to escort merchant ships on the North Atlantic convoy run, but they were not officially in the war. And there was, of course, a powerful pro-German and pro-Italian lobby in America. And basically, also people that just didn't want to be involved in another war because they'd been involved in World War One, and it cost, even when, though they came in 1917 in World War One, it cost them a lot of lives. So there was a powerful push in America to keep America out of the war. And it was only President Roosevelt who was very much into helping Britain and making sure his navy could assist where it could on the periphery through a thing called the Neutrality Patrol, where the Americans would patrol the seas to make sure that merchant ships in their orbit on their side of the Atlantic were safe from the depredations of not only U-boats, but also what they call high seas raiders like Bismarck and Prinz Eugen. And so they were involved in that way, but they basically were not in the war, and it could be they wouldn't come into the war, you know.
So why was the deployment of the Bismarck such a concern to the Royal Navy?
The Royal Navy was stretched across the world at that time. So although the German Navy was, let's say, 30% of the Royal Navy in terms of capital ships, submarines, destroyers, whatever, in fact, in European waters, it could achieve, I would say, almost parity with the Royal Navy, because the Royal Navy had to have a home fleet kept in British waters, but it also had to operate a Mediterranean fleet to handle the Italians and increasingly the Germans in the Mediterranean, and also had to be wary of the increasing threat of Japan in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. Plus, the Royal Navy had the onerous duty, which was quite a challenge, of escorting the Atlantic convoys from North America and also, of course, from Brazil, Argentina, along the coast of West Africa to Britain. So there was a whole network of convoys that had to be protected as well. So if you think of it as the Royal Navy is large, probably the biggest in the world then, even then, and probably the most famous and feared and professional and with an amazing psychological advantage over any opposing navy, the problem it had was it was spread thin around the world, and the Germans had some modern ships and some impressively powerful ships like Bismarck and her sister, not yet finished, Tirpitz, coming to challenge the Royal Navy, where it was finding it a challenge itself to keep them penned in and held at bay. So what they were worried about was that a high seas raider like Bismarck would break out into the North Atlantic, lose herself in the vastness of the sea, and then evade the hunters of the Royal Navy, which would have to leave convoys to go and find her. And so that would cause an immense amount of disruption in convoy traffic and could, as had happened in March 1941, see a high seas raider sink a lot of merchant ships.
And did the Royal Navy sort of learn any lessons from its action against the Bismarck? And did they change their tactics as a result?
I think what the Royal Navy did, and it's pertinent to Bismarck 24 hours to doom on the sidelines. When the German high seas raiders broke out in spring of 1941, that's the Scharnhorst, the Gneisenau, two battlecruisers, and also a pair of pocket battleships, that's heavily armed cruisers. When they broke out in the spring of 1941, what happened was the Royal Navy sent almost its entire force to try and stop some of those raiders. And what they learned, and which was perhaps unfortunate in some ways, by May 1941, was that you wouldn't deploy your main battle fleet, you wouldn't commit it until you knew more on where those vessels were trying to break out into the Atlantic. And so when Admiral Tovey, the commander of the home fleet, was sitting in his flagship, the battleship King George V, at Scapa Flow, where he had a phone line, a landline attached to intelligence sources on the mainland, he didn't deploy all of his ships in one direction at once, because if he did that, what could happen is they might go somewhere else and then they'd slip by and out into the Atlantic to savage the convoys. And that had happened in the spring. So this time, what he decided to do was wait with King George V and the aircraft carrier Victorious and other ships at Scapa Flow for more news via the landline, more intelligence, so that he could make his final decision on where to confront the high seas raider. But what he did as an interim measure was he sent HMS Hood and HMS Prince of Wales and a few destroyers off up towards the Denmark Strait to see if that was where Bismarck and the heavy cruiser were going to break out. And the Royal Navy already had two cruisers on patrol. The British cruisers Suffolk and Norfolk up in the Denmark Strait on what they call a patrol white, which was a terrible duty in awful seas, watching for German breakouts, spotted the Bismarck and her consort trying to break down through the Denmark Strait. And so Admiral Tovey knew that at least Hood and Prince of Wales would meet the Bismarck and the heavy cruiser. After the cataclysm of the loss of Hood, the two German high seas raiders headed off into the Atlantic, and they were shadowed by Prince of Wales and the cruisers Suffolk and Norfolk. And so the Royal Navy knew generally where they were going, and it sent units out to try, more units out, including King George V and the aircraft carrier Victorious, to try and intercept the Bismarck, principally, because it's the Bismarck they were really worried about. And what happened within hours of the Battle of the Denmark Strait, where Hood was blown up, was that HMS Victorious launched Swordfish torpedo bombers to attack Bismarck, but they scored just one hit. It was a very brave assault on the Bismarck, and they scored one hit, which killed one sailor in Bismarck. And that very slight damage, in fact, it was no damage at all, it just damaged some machinery, added to something more crucial, which was there were three hits scored by HMS Prince of Wales on Bismarck during the Battle of the Denmark Strait, one of which punctured a fuel tank. And that's very important in the story, because the loss of fuel meant that Admiral Lütjens, who was the commander of the raiding sortie, had to then decide, do I go back to Germany, or having achieved this amazing victory over the Royal Navy and destroyed Hood, or do I go to Brest for repairs? And he decided he would go to Brest. And so he headed off down to the southeast and abandoned an idea which had been in his mind, and also the mind of Admiral Dönitz, who was the head of the U-boat force, for Bismarck to lure British capital ships or cruisers, etc., onto U-boats. That plan was shelved. That was meant to happen to the southeast of Greenland. It didn't happen. And that is part of the story too. So Bismarck heads off to the southeast, exchanges fire with Prince of Wales and the Suffolk and the Norfolk, but in terrible weather. First of all, Bismarck says goodbye to the heavy cruiser, which goes off on her own raiding sortie. Bismarck heads off into the terrible fog and the mist, is lost by the Royal Navy cruisers. And so for 31 hours, nobody knows in the Admiralty in London or anywhere else where Bismarck is. And it could be she will escape. But for the British, who are trying to use all sorts of newfangled things like radar direction finding and also intelligence sources in France and code breaking, they're desperately trying to figure out where is Bismarck going, because we cannot let her get away having destroyed Hood without retribution. And we don't want Bismarck to join the Scharnhorst Gneisenau, two battle cruisers that caused so much trouble in March 1941 in Brest, where they will then emerge and three of them could cause even more havoc and disruption to the convoys. And so basically, the Royal Navy is pursuing, hunting wherever it can in the Atlantic and drawing in ships away from convoys to try and find Bismarck. And that is the essence of where we find ourselves during the documentary. And that final 24 hours in the chase and the final battle itself is what is in there. And the thing with the documentary and also the book is it's done on a clock. And so thanks to sources that I was able to draw on, I was able to construct in the original book a narrative that was on hour by hour, almost minute by minute. And that is something that has inspired the documentary. And so what we do is we start from the point of 31 hours after Bismarck has been lost at around 10:30 a.m. on the 26th of May, 1941. And a Catalina aircraft of the Royal Air Force flying from Northern Ireland spots what is a ship that could be Bismarck and sends out a signal, ship spotted. I'm summarizing it here. I'm not saying the exact signal. Ship spotted, and everybody goes, right, could that be Bismarck? We've got her. And that's when the whole drama that the documentary is focused on starts. And that's how we bring in the veterans as well.
Do you think some of these veteran interviews help dispel some of the myths and misunderstandings around the Bismarck action?
Yeah, I think the curious thing about the Bismarck action, the beginning of it was the 24th of May, the end of it was the 27th of May. And the thing that is remarkable, I found to be remarkable doing research and talking to the veterans, was that there seemed to be a bit of a black hole in that the drama of Hood blowing up, a terrible thing, you know, that's still remembered to this day and still felt, the loss is still felt amongst the relatives who gather and have reunions for the ship and remember that sacrifice. There seemed to be a bit of a mist around what happened thereafter. I mean, people think it's well known and they look at things like their chess pieces moved around on a board and this happened and that happened as if it was all kind of preordained. And they look at the technicalities of it, that Bismarck was this powerful and, you know, HMS Rodney, this battleship was had that many guns and 16-inch guns against Bismarck's 15-inch. And the mechanics of it are there and people draw conclusions from that. And there are, of course, good eyewitness accounts out there already in books. I'm not saying there aren't. But it seemed to me, in delving into the stuff in the archives that had been left by veterans, actually, since a lot of the accounts were written, and then my interviews with veterans for the book and for books, and then, crucially, the on-camera interviews, what was missing was the human side of the story of what really happened in that 24-hour period at the end of the chase and the battle. And what was missing was this ringside seat for the brutal and terrible reality of naval combat, close quarters, intricate, complex, but in the end, a brutal fight to the finish. And I thought that it was very curious that the senior officers involved, and this is where the guys I interviewed come into it, the senior officers involved hadn't left what I would consider to be really detailed accounts of what happened in that final battle. And I often wondered if it was because in some ways they found it too terrible and too awful to write about and just didn't want to talk about it. I mean, like the veterans themselves. And of course, the older men, Captain Dalrymple Hamilton, the commander of HMS Rodney, and Admiral Tovey, the boss of the Home Fleet, were both in their 50s. And so they were long gone before they were able to get together with these young men who I filmed and who were in the documentary, who were only 17, 18, 20 at most. And so they never reached that arc in their life where they felt able to discuss it. So for me, the story of the final 24 hours was untold from the British point of view, because there was a, you know, there have been German accounts of it as well. I just thought it was untold and needed that human input, that putting you there, feeling what those young men felt and seeing what they saw, you know, through their accounts.
Yeah. So with the veterans you interviewed, you kind of mentioned they were in the ringside seats of the battle. So where were they placed in the battle? Where were their sort of points of view from?
That's a good question. The veterans had different perspectives from different ships. So you had Ken Robinson in HMS Cossack, a small destroyer that took on Bismarck in a torpedo action at night to try and make sure the Royal Navy had her under observation and could basically tire out her crew, keep them harassed during the evening of the 26th of May. And then you've got Terry Goddard, who's a Fleet Air Arm observer in a Swordfish torpedo bomber, one of the legendary string bag biplanes, who was in the last aircraft to ever attack Bismarck and hit Bismarck with a torpedo and went up against Bismarck in this fragile canvas struts, you know, aircraft to try and cripple Bismarck's steering. And then you've got Yves Diaz and Len Nicol, who are in the battleship HMS Rodney, a battleship of 40,000 tons. Quite old, but a heavy hitter with 16-inch guns. So a variety of different perspectives and coming at it from different angles. The Royal Navy's objective was to try and stop Bismarck getting away. So the Swordfish torpedo bombers of Ark Royal, an aircraft carrier that had come up from Gibraltar and towards Bismarck, had to try and cripple the steering of the German battleship to stop her getting away, basically, to slow her down or stop her. And then you had the destroyers of the fourth destroyer flotilla. Added to them was a Polish destroyer called the Orpiron, but there were four British destroyers, and that Polish vessel were then asked to kind of keep an eye on Bismarck during the night. And then the hope then was, and people will have to watch a documentary, I know many people know what the story was, but maybe some people don't, and I don't want to spoil it for them, but the whole point then was that the big battleships, which were slower and needed time to get into action, were then coming down to hopefully take on Bismarck. And that's, it is very much, and it's, you know, the story is cinematic and is told in the documentary in a very cinematic way, with dramatic reenactments and also some amazing CGI and the veterans themselves talking to you about their part in this amazing drama. And, you know, it comes together in a fashion that, you know, I could only have dreamed of. I mean, it is really is the realization of the drama and the telling of the story in a dynamic way that I think will enable people to put themselves in the place of these young men. And at the time of the Bismarck action, the oldest veteran we see giving his testimony on camera was just 21. And so, you know, it's just amazing to see them talking about it and then to see it all brought to life so well with the actors and the CGI.
After the war, after all this is said and done, how did the veterans sort of feel about each other? Because I have read that there'd been some meetings between the Germans and British crews, and I find that really interesting.
That is, yeah, that's a remarkable aspect of it, is that the veterans themselves on the German side and the British side, at the end of all of that, as you say, yes, that's a remarkable side of this story, which is a good way to pay off the book and is worth observing also. In terms of what people see in the documentary, is that beyond the last 24 hours and what happens in that finale, and years later, the veterans of both the Royal Navy and the Kriegsmarine, the German side, actually did, some of them did actually meet up. And although they'd been fighting each other on the 27th of May, 1941, and engaged in trying to kill each other, they actually met up in the UK and in Germany post-war and got on with each other because they were fellow sailors, fellow mariners who faced the same common foe in the end, which is, you know, as Nicholas Montserrat said in his amazing novel, The Cruel Sea. The Cruel Sea. And so they, the veterans on both sides recognised that they were fellow sailors, fellow mariners. They faced this common foe of the sea. And beyond whatever the politicians do and whatever happens with geopolitics and the events of the time, their humanity, their common humanity as seafarers united them. And it's quite a touching and amazing bond that they established after the Second World War.
Yeah, I find that truly remarkable. That's brilliant.
And why wouldn't they have that common humanity? And one of the things that I think is important to understand about Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom story in the book, and also, you know, whatever you see in the documentary beyond the periphery of this amazing drama that unfolds on the screen, is that the Bismarck action was one part of a massive drama that stretched from 1939 to 1945. So when you see, for example, the veterans that are talking on screen in the documentary, some of those men later on in the war were in sometimes the same ships, sometimes other ships, other units that would face the Germans or the Japanese and would themselves either be sunk or lose shipmates at another time in another place. And so the wheel of fate, the wheel of fortune turns. And so one day you're, let's say, engaged in fighting the Germans. The next day you would be fighting the Japanese. And on the other side, the Germans had a long war too. And what we have to understand is that beyond the drama of Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom, the sailors, the Royal Marines, and also the aviators would themselves go on to see more action at sea, more combat, and would either have their own ships sunk or see their friends shot down or whatever. But they would go on for years more in the war. So it wasn't the end of the story for them. And so when it comes to meeting the former foe, as some of the veterans of the Bismarck action did after the war, they would share memories of the entire war and of the other events and understand that they had a common humanity and that it had been a long war and that they had both survived, you know, whichever side they were on.
So, Ian, before we wrap up today, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to add my special thanks to David Gilbert, the producer and showrunner of Screen Story, for spotting the potential of a TV project based on the little book that Agora Books so enthusiastically published. And David and his very talented crew have realised it superbly on screen. And they all worked very, very hard. And it's worth mentioning that it's been amazing bringing this gripping yarn to life powerfully on screen, because it enables the veterans to tell us about the Bismarck finale in their own words. And of course, they were remarkable chaps. And I know it's meant a massive amount to the families of the veterans who've been so brilliantly supportive of both the book and the TV documentary. I can only imagine how powerful and moving it will be for them to see their relatives talk about their experiences during the first broadcast on Channel 4 and the fact that they will get so much out of it makes it all worthwhile and ensures that the veterans have their place in history. And their accounts, I think, do help us to understand the reality of dangerous times that they lived in and broaden our understanding of the story, so that via the documentary and, of course, the book before it, even now, 80 years, there's still something fresh to tell us about the human condition. And I will add that a few of the veterans that I filmed and are in the book didn't actually make the final cut of the TV documentary for whatever reason. And I am hoping to soon get them in sound and hopefully vision too on my website, bismarckbattle.com. Finally, my thanks to esteemed naval historians, Peter Hoare, Chris Parry and Jane Harold, for jumping aboard with me as talking heads. And they help set the scene and explain the historical strategic context of the story, which frames and boosts the amazing power of the testimony of the veterans. And those three, they really do know their stuff. And of course, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom started as words on a page. And I must send a message of deep gratitude to Kate Evans, Sam Brace and Peyton Stableford at Agora Books and Tim Bates at PFD for commissioning the book and enabling me to present a terrific story to the world in its original form. And then, of course, as an expanded 80th anniversary edition this year. And it's quite amazing to think that my chats with the veterans could actually result in both a book and a Channel 4 primetime Saturday night documentary. I mean, it's quite stunning to think that my words on the page can then end up in a documentary that is so dramatic and so powerful. And in addition to the books, I've written about the Bismarck action in Warships International Fleet Review, and I'll be giving some more details on Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom in the next edition of the magazine, which is out on November the 19th. And I must thank the magazine's publishers, particularly Christine Knoll, who is at the helm there, for being so supportive in so many ways across the years for me in general, but also in basically sponsoring and hosting this special edition of Warships Pod.
Where can listeners see the documentary and find out more about you and your work on the Bismarck?
Well, the documentary has its world premiere at 6:55 p.m. on the 30th of October on Channel 4, that's the UK national broadcaster. And people can find out more about me and my books on the Bismarck action, in particular Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom, on bismarckbattle.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for interrogating me, Chris.
My pleasure. Hopefully it wasn't too bad.
No, it was great. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Warships IFR podcast. If you'd like to obtain the magazine itself, please visit your local newsagent and pick one up from the shelf. Or, if you like, ask them if they can order it in. Alternatively, visit the Warships IFR website, warshipsifr.com, and you can obtain it that way. You can subscribe to get a hard copy each month direct to you wherever you are in the world, or get a digital edition. You can connect with us via Warships IFR on Facebook. That's at Warships IFR, very easy to remember. Follow us on Twitter on at Warships IFR, or check out our amazing videos of warships themselves on YouTube, which is called Warships IFR TV. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.